Former Vice President Al Gore gave a major address on civil liberties and anti-terrorism at the Daughters of the American Revolution Constitution Hall in Washington, D.C. on Sunday, November 9th. The speech was co-sponsored by MoveOn.org and the American Constitution Society. It was broadcast live on C-SPAN and WorldLink Television, as well as on the Internet. Former Vice President of the United States, Al Gore.
For my part, I'm just a recovering politician, but I truly believe that some of the issues that are most important to America's future are ones that all of us should be dealing with, and perhaps the most important of these issues is the one that I came here to talk about today, and that is the true relationship between freedom and security. So it seems to me that the logical place to start this discussion is with an accounting of exactly what has happened to civil liberties and security since the vicious attacks against America of September 11, 2001. And it's important to note at the outset that the administration and the Congress have brought about many beneficial and needed improvements to make law enforcement and intelligence community efforts more effective against potential terrorists. But it's also true that a whole lot of other changes have taken place that a lot of people don't know about and that come as unwelcome surprises. I want to give you some examples. First, for the first time in our history, American citizens have been seized by the executive branch of government and put in prison without being charged with a crime, without having the right to a trial, without being able to see a lawyer, and without even being able to contact their families. President Bush is claiming the unilateral right to do that to any American citizen that he believes is an enemy combatant. Those are the magic words, enemy combatant. If the president alone decides that those two words accurately describe someone, then that person can be immediately locked up and held incommunicado for as long as the president wants, with no court having the right to determine whether the facts actually justify his imprisonment. Now, if the president makes a mistake or is given faulty information by somebody working for him and locks up the wrong person, then it's almost impossible for that person to prove his innocence because he can't talk to a lawyer or his family or anyone else. And he doesn't even have the right to know what specific crime he is accused of committing. So a constitutional right to liberty and the pursuit of happiness that we used to think of in an old-fashioned way as inalienable can now be instantly stripped from any American by the president with no meaningful review by any other branch of government. Now, how do we feel about that? Is that okay? Well, here's another recent change in our civil liberties. Now, if it wants to, the federal government has the right to monitor every website you go to on the Internet, keep a list of everyone you send email to or receive email from, and everyone you call on the telephone or who calls you, and they don't even have to show probable cause that you've done anything wrong. Nor do they have to report ever to any court on what they're doing with the information. Moreover, there are precious few safeguards in this system they've set up to keep them from reading the content of all your email. Now, is everybody fine with that? Well, what about this next change? For America's first 212 years, it used to be that if the police wanted to search your house, they had to be able to convince an independent judge to give them a search warrant. And then, with rare exceptions, they had to go and bang on your door and yell, "Open up." And then if you didn't quickly open up, they could knock the door down. And then if they seized anything, also, they had to leave a list explaining what they had taken. That way, if it was all a terrible mistake, as it sometimes is, you could go and get your stuff back. But that's all changed now. Starting 2 years ago, federal agents were given broad new statutory authority by the Patriot Act to sneak and peek in non-terrorism cases. In other words, they can secretly enter your home with no warning, whether you're there or not, and they can wait for months before telling you that they were there. They can copy stuff or alter stuff, take stuff. It doesn't have to have any relationship to terrorism whatsoever. It applies to any garden variety crime. And this new law makes it very easy to get around the need for a traditional warrant simply by saying that searching your house might have some connection, even a remote one, to the investigation of some agent of a foreign power. Then they can go to another court, which is a secret court, that more or less has to give them a warrant whenever they ask for one. Now, 3 weeks ago, in a speech at FBI headquarters, President Bush went even further and formally proposed that the Attorney General be allowed to authorize subpoenas himself by administrative order without the need for a warrant from any court. So, here's another one. What about the right to consult a lawyer if you're arrested? That seems like it's pretty important. But Attorney General Ashcroft has issued regulations authorizing the secret monitoring of attorney-client conversations on his own say-so without any prior judicial review, and that's been required in the past in the rare instances when it was permitted in the past. So now, whoever is taken into custody really has to assume that the government is listening to their conversations with their lawyers. Now, does it matter if the government listens in on everything you say to your lawyer? Is that okay? Well, let's take another change. And thanks to the librarians, more people know about this one. The FBI now has the right to go into any library and ask for the records of everybody who's used the library and get a list of who is reading what. Similarly, the FBI can demand all the records of banks, colleges, hotels, hospitals, credit card companies, and a lot of other companies. And these changes are only the beginning. There are more on the way. Just last week, Attorney General Ashcroft issued more brand new guidelines, these to permit the FBI to run credit checks and background checks and gather other information about anyone who is of investigatory interest. That's the phrase, meaning anyone who the agent thinks is suspicious without any evidence of criminal behavior being involved at all. Is that fine with everybody? See, I think people in the country looking at these changes sort of feel that way too. And I hope so. I really do believe so. Listen to this language from the highest court in Israel that dealt with a similar question when in 1999, not too long ago, it was asked to balance due process rights against dire threats to the security of the Israeli people, and they have some. Here's what the court said there. This is the destiny of democracy, as not all means are acceptable to it, and not all practices employed by its enemies are open before it. Although a democracy must often fight with one hand tied behind its back, it nonetheless has the upper hand. Preserving the rule of law and recognition of an individual's liberty constitutes an important component in its understanding of security. At the end of the day, they add to its strength. That's a pretty good opinion. If they can reach that conclusion in Israel, it's hard to say that they haven't had to cope with more serious threats to the security of their people. So I'm here today to challenge the Bush administration's implicit assumption that we have to give up many of our traditional freedoms in order to be safe from terrorists, because it is simply not true. In fact, and I'm going to give some details on why, but in my opinion, it makes no more sense to launch an assault on our civil liberties as the best way to get at terrorists than it did to launch an invasion of Iraq as the best way to get at Osama bin Laden.
You're listening to a speech on civil liberties and anti-terrorism by former Vice President of the United States, Al Gore. This is community-supported radio, KVMR-FM.
In both cases, the administration has attacked the wrong target. In both cases, they have recklessly put our country in grave and unnecessary danger while avoiding and neglecting obvious and much more important challenges that would actually help to protect the country. In both cases, the administration has fostered false impressions and misled the nation with superficial, emotional, and manipulative presentations that are not worthy of America's democracy. And we deserve better. And we can do better. In both cases, they have exploited public fears for partisan political gain and postured themselves as bold defenders of our country while actually weakening, not strengthening, America. In both cases, they have used unprecedented secrecy and deception in order to avoid accountability to the Congress, the courts, the press, and the people. Indeed, this administration has turned the fundamental presumption of our democracy on its head. A government of and for the people is supposed to be generally open to public scrutiny by the people. It's our government. It's not their government. It belongs to the American people, and they can't keep everything secret from us. Now, while the government's supposed to be open to scrutiny by the people, the private information of the people themselves should be routinely protected from government intrusion. They've got it backwards. This administration is seeking to conduct its work in secret, even as it demands broad, unfettered access to personal private information from American citizens. That's backwards. Under the rubric of protecting national security, they have obtained new powers to gather information from citizens and keep it secret. Yet at the same time, they themselves refuse to disclose information that is highly relevant to the war against terrorism. They are even arrogantly refusing to provide information about 9/11 in their possession to the 9/11 Commission, the lawful investigative body charged with examining not only the Bush administration's performance, but also the actions of the prior administration in which I served. And that's proper. The whole point is to learn all we can about preventing future terrorist attacks. Now, just 2 days ago, that commission was forced to issue a subpoena to the Pentagon, which has disgracefully put Secretary Rumsfeld's desire to avoid embarrassment ahead of the nation's need to learn how we can best avoid future terrorist attacks. And that same commission has served notice that it will also issue a subpoena to the White House if the president continues to withhold information that he has that's essential to the 9/11 Commission investigation. But they haven't given it up yet. And the White House is also refusing to respond to repeated bipartisan congressional requests for information about 9/11, even though the Congress is simply exercising its oversight authority pursuant to the Constitution. In the words of Senator McCain, and I quote, excessive administration secrecy on issues related to the September 11 attacks feeds conspiracy theories and reduces the public's confidence in government. Now, in a revealing move just 3 days ago, the White House asked the Republican leadership of the Senate to shut down the Intelligence Committee's investigation of 9/11 based on a trivial political dispute. Now, apparently, the President is anxious to keep the Congress from seeing what are said to have been clear, strong, and explicit warnings directly to him a few weeks before 9/11 that terrorists were planning to hijack commercial airliners and use them to attack us. Astonishingly, the Republican Senate leadership quickly complied with the President's request. Such obedience and complicity in what looks like a cover-up from the majority party in a separate and supposedly co-equal branch of government makes it seem like a very long time ago when a Republican Attorney General and his deputy resigned rather than comply with an order to fire the special prosecutor investigating Richard Nixon. That took integrity and courage. In an even more brazen move, more than 2 years after the administration rounded up over 1,200 individuals of Arab descent, they still refused to release the names of the individuals they detained, even though virtually every one of those arrested has been cleared by the FBI of any connection to terrorism. And there's no justification under national security whatsoever for keeping those names secret. Yet at the very same time, White House officials themselves leaked the name of a CIA operative serving this country in clear violation of the law. Apparently, in an effort to get at her husband, who had angered them by disclosing that the President had relied on forged evidence in his State of the Union address as part of the effort to convince the country that Saddam Hussein was on the verge of building nuclear weapons. But John Ashcroft is on that leaker case. Now, even as they claim to see the private bank records of every American, they are also adopting a new policy on the Freedom of Information Act that actively encourages federal agencies to fully consider all potential reasons for nondisclosure, regardless of whether the disclosure would actually be harmful. In other words, they've sent out the word that the federal government will now actively resist complying with any request for information. And moreover, they've established a new exemption from the Freedom of Information Act that lets them refuse to release to the press or the public important health, safety, and environmental information that businesses are required by law to submit to the government if they just call it critical infrastructure. Now, here's the point. By closely guarding information about their own behavior, they are dismantling a fundamental element of our system of checks and balances. Because so long as the government's actions are secret, they can't be held accountable. Again, a government for the people and by the people must be transparent to the people. That has to be the basic presumption. And they cannot get away with turning that on its head. Now, they're collecting all this information about American citizens, and they're justifying the collection of it all by saying, in effect, that if they have all this information about all of us, it'll make the country safer for them to have it. But, you know, that's not the kind of information that would have been of much help in preventing 9/11. There's a whole lot of it, but it's not the kind that's relevant to a terrorist attack, by and large. But there was information, a lot of it, very specific information, that was available prior to 9/11 that probably could have been used to prevent the tragedy. A recent analysis by the Merkel Foundation, and they worked with a company that got venture capital from a CIA-sponsored firm. This is a group that knows what they're talking about. They demonstrated this point in a startling way. And this is some information that I didn't know about 9/11, and I'm going to tell you what this report said. It points out that in late August of 2001, two of the hijackers, Nawak al-Hamzi and Khalid al-Midhar, bought their tickets to fly on American Airlines Flight 77, the one that flew into the Pentagon, using their own real names. And both of their names were then on a State Department INS watch list called tip-off, because both men were being sought by the FBI and the CIA as suspected terrorists because they had been observed at a terrorist meeting in Malaysia. If they had those names and they bought their tickets with those names, and if those names had been checked, there would have been an exact match against that tip-off list. And that would have been just the first step, because then they could have started checking other information. If they just looked for common addresses, which is widely available, the analysts would have discovered that one of the other hijackers that also bought a seat on American 77, Salim al-Hazmi, used the same address as one of the first two. And more importantly, they would have discovered that Mohammed Atta, who was on American 11 that hit the North Tower of the World Trade Center, and Marwan al-Shehhi, who was on United 175 that hit the South Tower of the Trade Center, used the same address as the al-Midhar guy. And then if they checked for identical frequent flyer numbers, they would have discovered that Majad Moked, who was a hijacker, had used the same number as one of those guys. And so once they identified Mohammed Atta, they could have also added other information. If they had checked publicly available phone numbers, they would have identified five other hijackers. And then if they had looked at a further check of the more innocuous INS watch list that includes expired visas, among other things, they would have identified yet another hijacker, and then they could have started the same relatively simple correlation analysis and gotten the rest of the hijackers. And two of these terrorists who were on the list, while they were being looked for, they rented an apartment in San Diego, again under their own name. They got a telephone listing under their own names in the San Diego phone book while the FBI and the CIA are looking for them. Here's my point. What we need is better and more timely analysis, not all this information collected about the American people, simply piling up more raw information, most of which is entirely irrelevant to what's going on, is not going to help. In fact, it may actually hurt the cause. Here's what one FBI agent said privately about Attorney General Ashcroft. He said, and I quote, "We're looking for a needle in a haystack here, and he just keeps piling more hay on the stack." It's a pretty good point. In other words, the mass collection of personal data on hundreds of millions of American citizens actually makes it more difficult to protect the nation against terrorists, so they ought to cut out most of that and focus on analyzing the information that is directly relevant. And, of course, there's no reason to think that going after personal information about American citizens is the place to start anyway. The real story is that while the administration manages to convey the impression that it's doing everything possible to protect America, in reality, it has seriously neglected many of the measures that it could have taken to really make our country safer. For example, there's still no serious strategy for domestic security that protects critical infrastructure, such as electric power lines, gas pipelines, nuclear facilities, ports, chemical plants, and the like. They're still not checking most incoming cargo carriers for radiation. They're still skimping on protection of certain nuclear weapons storage facilities. They're still not hardening critical facilities, some of which must never be soft targets for terrorists. They're still not investing in the translators and analysts that we need to counter the growing terror threat. They're still not investing in local government training and infrastructures where they could make the biggest difference. The first responder community is still being shortchanged. In many cases, fire and police still can't talk to one another on their communications equipment. The Centers for Disease Control and local hospitals and medical personnel are still nowhere close to being ready for a biological weapons attack. The administration still failed to address the fundamental disorganization and rivalries of our law enforcement, intelligence, and investigative agencies, in particular the critical CIA-FBI coordination, which, while finally improved at the top, still remains dysfunctional down in the trenches. So, you know, these constant violations of civil liberties promote the false impression that those violations are necessary in order for them to take every precaution against another terrorist attack. But the simple truth is that the vast majority of those violations have not benefited our security at all. In fact, they have hurt the effort to improve our security. They may want to posture one way, but the truth is another way. And probably the worst example is their treatment of immigrants. This mass mistreatment most of us are American citizens. There's a natural tendency, just human nature, to say, oh, well, it's only immigrants, only non-citizens. But let me tell you, this mass mistreatment, first of all, it was wrong, but it actually hurt our security in a number of ways. And let's be clear about what happened. This really was little more than a cheap and cruel political stunt by John Ashcroft. More than 99% of those mostly Arab background men who were rounded up had just done things like overstay their visas or committed some other minor offense while they were trying to pursue the American dream, just like most immigrants. But they were used as extras in the administration's effort to give the impression that they'd caught a huge number of bad guys. And then so many of them were treated horribly and abusively in our name. Now, let me just give you one example. This example was reported in depth by Anthony Lewis. This man's name is Ansar Mahmood, a Pakistani who had overstayed his visa. He was arrested in New York on October 3rd, 2001. The next day, he was briefly questioned by FBI agents who said now they had no further interest in him. Then, though, he was shackled in handcuffs, leg irons, and a belly chain and taken to the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn. Guards there put two more sets of handcuffs on him and another set of leg irons. One of them threw Mahmood against a wall. The guards forced him to run down a long ramp with the irons cutting into his wrists and ankles. The physical abuse was mixed with verbal taunts, and after 2 weeks, he was allowed to make a telephone call to his wife. She wasn't at home, so he was told that he'd have to wait another 6 weeks before he could try to call her again. It sounds unbelievable. Let me tell you, this happened to lots and lots of these people that were rounded up because they got lumped in with the whole impression that, you know, this was a potential terrorist roundup, and they were just these minor visa violations. Finally, he saw his wife 3 months after his arrest, and all during the visit, all during the time he was confined, he was kept in solitary confinement in a windowless cell with 2 overhead fluorescent lights on 24 hours a day. In the end, he was charged with using an invalid Social Security card and deported in May of 2002, nearly 8 months after his arrest. Now, The faith tradition that I share with John Ashcroft includes this teaching from Jesus: whatsoever you do unto the least of these, you do unto me.
You're listening to a speech on civil liberties and anti-terrorism by former Vice President of the United States, Al Gore. This is community-supported radio, KVMR-FM.
Make no mistake, the disgraceful treatment suffered by many of these vulnerable immigrants at the hands of the administration has created deep resentments and hurt the cooperation desperately needed from the immigrant communities in the United States and from the security services of their countries of origin. And secondly, these gross violations of their rights have seriously damaged United States moral authority and goodwill around the world and delegitimized our efforts to continue promoting human rights. They call us hypocrites. So don't tell me you're protecting our national security by rounding up a bunch of people who have nothing to do with threatening our national security and abusing them. In fact, as one analyst put it, we used to set the standard in the world, and now we've lowered the bar. And after all, our moral authority in the United States of America is our greatest source of enduring strength in the world. And we ought to safeguard it, and we ought to care about it and respect it and not toss it away. And let me tell you, the handling of those prisoners at Guantanamo has been particularly harmful to America's image. Even England and Australia, you can't get better, stronger allies than that, have criticized our departure from international law and the Geneva Convention. Secretary Rumsfeld's handling of the captives there has been about as thoughtful as his post-war plan for Iraq. I don't think he thought either one of them through very well. And so, the mass violations of civil liberties have hurt rather than helped. But there's yet another reason for urgency in stopping and reversing what this administration is doing where civil liberties are concerned. And it's this: they have already taken us farther down the road toward an intrusive Big Brother-style government, toward the dangers prophesied by George Orwell in his book 1984 than anyone ever thought would have been possible in the United States of America. And they have done it primarily by heightening and exploiting public anxieties and apprehensions. Rather than leading with a call to courage, this administration has chosen to lead us by inciting fear. Over and over again. Almost 80 years ago, Justice Louis Brandeis wrote this: those who won our independence by revolution were not cowards. They did not exalt order at the cost of liberty. Those who won our independence, Brandeis asserted, understood that courage is the secret of liberty and fear breeds only repression. We need a call to courage in America as part of our response to balancing civil liberties and national security. But rather than defending our freedoms, this administration has sought to abandon them. Rather than accepting our traditions of openness and accountability, this administration has opted to rule by secrecy and unquestioned authority. Instead, its assaults on our core democratic principles have only left us less free and less secure. You know, throughout American history, what we now call civil liberties have often been abused and limited during times of war and perceived threats to our security. The best-known instances include the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798 to 1800, the brief suspension of habeas corpus during the Civil War, the extreme abuses during World War I and the notorious Red Scare and Palmer Raids immediately after World War I, the shameful internment of Japanese Americans during World War II, and then the excesses of the FBI and CIA during the Vietnam War and social turmoil of the late 60s and early 70s. But in each of these cases, our nation has eventually recovered its equilibrium when the war ended and absorbed the lessons learned in a recurring cycle of excess and regret. But there are reasons for concern this time around that what we are now experiencing may no longer be the first half of a recurring cycle, but rather the beginning of something new. For one thing, this war is predicted by the administration to last for the rest of our lives. You've heard them say that. Others have expressed the view that over time the war on terrorism will come to resemble the war against drugs. That is, it will become a more or less permanent struggle that occupies a significant part of our law enforcement and security agenda. Now, if that's the case, then when, if ever, does this encroachment on our freedoms die a natural death, if it goes on and on? It's important to remember that throughout history, the loss of civil liberties by individuals and the aggregation of too much unchecked power in the executive go hand in hand. They are two sides of the same coin. A second reason to worry that what we're witnessing here is a discontinuity and not another turn of the recurring cycle is that the new technologies of surveillance, long anticipated by novelists like Orwell and other prophets of the police state, are now more widespread than they have ever been. And these technologies do have the potential for shifting the balance between the apparatus of the state and the freedom of the individual in ways both subtle and profound. And these technologies are now being widely used not only by the government but also by corporations and other private entities, and that's relevant to how we assess the new requirements in the Patriot Act for so many corporations, especially in the finance industries, but other industries as well, they now have to prepare millions of reports annually on suspicious activities by their customers and send them to the government. And this new fact is also relevant to analyzing other provisions of the Patriot Act, which give these companies new flexibility in spite of what privacy laws say, to share with one another information that they collect about their customers. Now, there's a third reason for concern about this new cycle becoming kind of permanent, and that is that the threat of more terror strikes is all too real, and the potential use of weapons of mass destruction by terrorist groups does create a new practical imperative for the speedy exercise of discretionary power by the executive branch. Just as the emergence of nuclear weapons and ICBMs created a new practical imperative in the Cold War that altered the balance of war-making responsibility between the Congress and the President. But President Bush has stretched this new practical imperative way beyond what is healthy for our democracy. Indeed, one of the ways he has tried to maximize his power within the American system has been by constantly emphasizing his role as commander-in-chief far more than any previous president, assuming it as often and as visibly as he can and bringing it into the domestic arena and conflating it with his other roles as head of government and head of state, and especially with his political role as head of the Republican Party. Indeed, the most worrisome new factor, in my view, is the aggressive ideological approach of the current administration, which seems determined to use fear as a political tool to consolidate its power and escape any accountability for its use. Just as unilateralism and dominance are the guiding principles of their disastrous approach to international relations, they are also the guiding impulses of the administration's approach to domestic politics. They are impatient with any constraints on the exercise of power overseas, whether from our allies or the United Nations or international law And in the same way, they are impatient with any obstacles to their use of power at home, whether from the Congress, the courts, the press, or the rule of law. For example, John Ashcroft has authorized FBI agents to attend church meetings and rallies and political meetings and any other citizen activity open to the public simply on the agent's own initiative, thereby reversing a decades-old policy that required justification to superiors before such infiltrations could take place, and they would have to show a provable connection to a legitimate investigation. They've even taken steps that seem to be clearly aimed at stifling dissent. The Bush Justice Department has recently begun a highly disturbing criminal prosecution of the environmental group Greenpeace because of a nonviolent direct action protest against what Greenpeace claimed was the illegal importation of endangered mahogany from the Amazon. Independent legal experts and historians have said that this prosecution under an obscure and bizarre 1872 law against sailor mongering, I'm not making that up, appears to be aimed at inhibiting Greenpeace's First Amendment activities. Now, at the same time they're breaking new ground by prosecuting Greenpeace, the Bush administration announced just a few days ago that they're dropping the investigation of 50 power plants for violating the Clean Air Act. In a move that Chuck Schumer said, and I'm quoting him, basically announced to the power industry that it can now pollute with impunity. The politicization of law enforcement in this administration is part of their larger agenda to roll back the changes in government policy brought about by the New Deal and the progressive movement. That's what they're all about. Toward that end, they're cutting back on civil rights enforcement, women's rights, progressive taxation, the estate tax, access to the courts, Medicare, and much more. And they approach every issue as a partisan fight to the finish, even in the areas of national security and terror. Instead of trying to make the war on terrorism a bipartisan cause, the Bush White House has consistently tried to exploit it for partisan advantage. The president goes to war verbally against terrorists in virtually every campaign speech and fundraising dinner for his political party. It's his main political theme now. Democratic candidates like Max Cleland in Georgia were labeled unpatriotic for voting differently from the White House on obscure amendments to the Homeland Security Bill. Don't tell me Max Cleland is unpatriotic. When the Republican leader in the House of Representatives, Tom DeLay, was embroiled in an effort to pick up more congressional seats in Texas by forcing a highly unusual redistricting vote in the state Senate, he was able to track down Democratic legislators who fled the state to prevent a quorum and thus prevent the vote by enlisting the help of President Bush's new Department of Homeland Security, enlisting as many as 13 employees of the Federal Aviation Administration who conducted an 8-hour search, and at least one FBI agent, although several other FBI agents who were asked to help refused to do so. But by locating the Democrats quickly with the technology put in place for tracking terrorists, the Republicans were able to succeed in focusing public pressure on the weakest of the senators and forced passage of their new political redistricting plan. Now, thanks in part to the efforts of three different federal agencies, President Bush and Tom DeLay are celebrating the gain of up to seven new Republican congressional seats in the next Congress. The White House timing for its big push for a vote in Congress on going to war with Iraq also happened to coincide exactly with the start of the fall election campaign in September a year ago. The president's chief of staff said the timing was chosen because from a marketing point of view, you don't introduce new products in August. The old product was the war on terrorism. The new product was the war against Iraq, I guess. White House political advisor Karl Rove advised Republican candidates, thanks to that computer disk that somebody found, that their best political strategy was, in his words, to run on the war. And then as soon as the troops began to mobilize, the Republican National Committee distributed yard signs all across America saying, and I quote, "I support President Bush and the troops," as if they were one and the same. This persistent effort to politicize the war in Iraq and politicize the war against terrorism for partisan advantage is obviously harmful to the prospects for bipartisan support of the nation's security policy. By sharp contrast, consider a very different approach that was taken by Winston Churchill during the terrible days of October 1943 in the midst of World War II, when he faced a controversy that was about to divide the bipartisan coalition that he led. He said this, "What holds us together is the prosecution of the war. No man has been asked to give up his convictions. That would be indecent and improper. We are held together by something outside which rivets our attention. The principle that we work on is everything for the war, whether controversial or not, and nothing controversial that is not bona fide for the war. That is our position." And then he went on to add this. He said, "We must also be careful that a pretext is not made of war needs to introduce far-reaching social or political changes by a side wind," end quote. Yet that is precisely what the Bush administration is attempting to do, to use the war against terrorism for partisan advantage and introduce far-reaching controversial changes in social policy by a side wind in an effort to consolidate its political power. And it is unworthy of our democracy.
You are listening to a speech on civil liberties and anti-terrorism by former Vice President of the United States, Al Gore. This is community-supported radio, KVMR-FM.
It is also an approach that is deeply antithetical to the American spirit. Respect for our president is important, but so is respect for the American people. Our founders knew, and our history has proven, that freedom is best guaranteed not by unthinking trust in a single individual, but by a separation of powers into co-equal branches of government in a system of checks and balances, precisely to prevent the unhealthy concentration of too much power in the hands of any one person or group. And our framers were also keenly aware that the history of the world proves that republics are fragile. In the very hour of America's birth in Philadelphia, when Benjamin Franklin was asked, "What have we got, a republic or a monarchy?" He said, "A republic if you can keep it." And even in the midst of our greatest testing, Lincoln knew that our fate here was tied to the larger question of whether any nation so conceived could long endure. This administration simply does not seem to agree that the challenge of preserving democratic freedom cannot be met unless by surrendering core American values. Incredibly, this administration has attempted to compromise the most precious rights that America has stood for all over the world for more than 200 years: due process, equal treatment under the law, the dignity of the individual, freedom from unreasonable search and seizure, freedom from promiscuous government surveillance. And in the name of security, this administration has attempted to relegate the Congress and the courts to the sidelines, to replace our democratic system of checks and balances with a more unaccountable executive. All the while, it is constantly angled for new ways to exploit that sense of crisis for partisan gain and political dominance. How dare they? How dare they? Years ago, during World War II, one of our most eloquent Supreme Court justices, Robert Jackson, wrote that the president should be given, in his words, widest latitude in wartime. But then he warned against the loose and irresponsible invocation of war as an excuse for discharging the executive branch from the rules of law that govern our republic in times of peace. He went on to say, no penance would ever expiate the sin against free government of holding that a president can escape control of executive powers by law through assuming his military role. Our government has ample authority under the Constitution to take those steps which are genuinely necessary for our security. At the same time, our system demands that government act only on the basis of measures that have been the subject of open and thoughtful debate in Congress and among the American people, and that invasions of the liberty or equal dignity of any individual are subject to review by courts which are open to those affected and independent of the government which is curtailing their freedom. He said it pretty well. So what should be done? Well, to begin with, our country ought to find a way to immediately stop its policy of indefinitely detaining American citizens without charges and without a judicial determination that their detention is proper. That is un-American. Incompatible with American traditions and values. That's incompatible with the sacred principles of due process of law and separation of powers. Now, it's no accident that our Constitution requires in criminal prosecutions a speedy and public trial. The principles of liberty and the accountability of government at the heart of what makes America unique require no less. The Bush administration's treatment of American citizens that it calls enemy combatants is simply wrong and nothing short of un-American, and it ought to stop right now. Secondly, foreign citizens held in Guantanamo should be given hearings to determine their status provided for under Article 5 of the Geneva Convention. That is a hearing that every other president in the United States has always given those captured in every war until this one, including Vietnam, including the Gulf War. If we don't provide this, how can we expect American soldiers captured overseas to be treated with equal respect? We owe this to our sons and daughters who are fighting now in Iraq and in Afghanistan and elsewhere. Third, the president should seek congressional authorization for the military commissions he says he intends to use instead of civilian courts to try some of those who are charged with violating the laws of war. Military commissions are exceptional in American law, and they present unique dangers. The prosecutor and the judge both work for the same man, the president of the United States. Such commissions may be appropriate in time of war, but they must be authorized by Congress, as they were in World War II. And Congress needs to look at it, delineate the scope of their authority. Review of their decisions ought to be available in a civilian court, at least the Supreme Court. That's the way it was handled in World War II. Next, our nation's greatness is measured by how we treat those who are the most vulnerable. Non-citizens who the government seeks to detain should be entitled to some basic right. The administration must stop abusing the material witness statute. That was designed to hold witnesses briefly before they're called to testify before a grand jury. It's been misused by this administration as a pretext for indefinite detention without charge, and that's simply not right. Now, finally, I have studied the Patriot Act, and I found that along with its many excesses, it contains a few needed changes in the law. And it's certainly true as well that many of the worst abuses of due process and civil liberties that are now occurring are taking place not according to the Patriot Act, but under the color of laws and executive orders other than the Patriot Act. Nevertheless, I believe that the Patriot Act has turned out to be, on balance, a terrible mistake, and that it became a kind of Tonkin Gulf resolution conferring Congress's blessing for this president's assault on civil liberties. Therefore, I believe strongly that the few good measures of this law should be passed again in a new and smaller law, but the Patriot Act should be repealed. And I hope you'll help convince Congress to repeal the Patriot Act as a first step to protecting our freedom. As John Adams wrote in 1780, ours is a government of laws and not of men. What is at stake today is that defining principle of our nation, and thus the very nature of our country. As the Supreme Court has written, our Constitution is a covenant running from the first generation of Americans to us and then onward to future generations. The Constitution includes no wartime exception, though its framers knew well the reality of war. And as Justice Holmes reminded us shortly before World War I, the Constitution's principles only have value if we apply them in the difficult times as well as those where it matters less. The question before us could be of no greater moment. Will we continue to live as a people under the rule of law as embodied in our Constitution, or will we fall? Will we fail future generations by leaving them a Constitution far diminished from the Charter of Liberty that we inherited from our forebears? Our choice is clear. Thank you for coming today.
You've been listening to a speech on civil liberties and anti-terrorism given by former Vice President of the United States, Al Gore. Gore delivered his speech at the Daughters of the American Revolution Constitution Hall in Washington, D.C. on Sunday, November 9th. The event was co-sponsored by MoveOn.org and the American Constitution Society. You're listening to community-supported radio, KVMR-FM, Nevada City, Music of the World, Voice of the Community.